And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conan. How do you do?
Good afternoon.
And today we're going to be speaking to Professor Yakov Rabkin. He is a professor of contemporary history at the University of Montreal. He's the author of a very influential book, a highly respected, titled A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. And we're particularly interested in getting the professor's opinions of the recent hubbub over the talk of the remarks of Prime Minister Netanyahu and concerning the Mufti of Jerusalem. And at the 5:30 point, we're going to also be going to Montreal to talk to author and publisher Robin Philpott, because we'll get into the issue of the federal election and how the votes went in Quebec, because it was there that the NDP lost a large number of seats. We'd like to have an explanation of that and what is going on in those quarters. Also, we're told that there is a public sector strike. It's a rotating strike. And we've been impressed and thought we should share with our listeners the fact that there have been common front demonstrations, public sector workers, of 150,000 people. But we saw no photographs of that in our local press. And so we thought it was kind of important to share that. Maybe there's some unwritten message here that it's not a good idea to talk about these things. But we feel that we have a public sector situation here where the teachers are being told their pay will be docked in this situation. So, which is not a pretty story. There is no response of that sort that I'm aware of amongst the union organized people.
And the teachers have been working for a year without a contract, and yet they still go to work every day. Yeah. And the premier says, well, that's not good enough. We're going to dock your pay.
Dock your pay. Yeah. So it's always important. It's like when we had the student demonstrations in Montreal and Quebec against tuition increases. Here, there was also opposition, but nothing on that magnitude. And it's partly because there's not sufficient communication where people know. Because, as you know, demonstrations are somewhat infectious. I tell you before we speak to Professor Rabkin that you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us on the web, taylor-report.com. And Phil, we have an announcement or two, do we not?
We do certainly have an announcement about this week, Wednesday at University College 144, and that is a talk called Crisis in the Desert, Who Rules the Sahara? And Martin Klein, a professor emeritus in the University of Toronto, who taught African history for 29 years, and he is going to write about the crisis governance in a very important part of the world, and the fact that it seems to be dominated by one family. They just get to do what they want. I don't know if you saw the news today that a prince from Saudi Arabia in his private plane was detained in Lebanon's airport by the Lebanese police because his private plane was packed with drugs to be delivered to the ISIS forces.
Really?
Yes.
No, for ISIS.
For ISIS. That's what the Lebanese police said because they didn't let the plane take off.
What's that? So that's like you mercenaries with benefits.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Of course. There you go. There's the expression.
Yeah, we pay you $25 an hour and, your heroin, cocaine, depending upon your taste. Well, another one, by the way, a prince was arrested in Los Angeles in his mansion because he seemed to have lost his mind and thought he could rape everybody in the building, and telling everybody that he was a prince and they were nothing. And somewhere along the line, police decided that actually wasn't appropriate conduct. And so he is, I'm sure, will call Dad, and the State Department will tell him to go home and apologize to Dad for having bothered his prince. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. And so does that cover our announcements?
Yes, that's covered,
I should tell our listeners, I attended a different book list, had a great 20th anniversary celebration at Steelworkers Hall on Saturday, and what an impressive gathering that was. The house was full. And people who really care about the black culture and literature and whatnot were in attendance. And we'll talk about that. But I believe we're joined now by Professor Yakov Rapkin. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I mentioned to our audience that you have written a very influential book called A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. And it seemed to me that we ought to take the occasion of the recent moment where the leader of Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was giving a speech to the World Zionist Congress, and many in the room were startled that he said the following. I have this from, I think it's Associated Press. He says, Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And he had a visit from Amin al-Hassani Husseini, who went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll come here. So what should I do with them, Hitler is alleged to have said. And he asked, and he was told, burn them. Now, that really set off, talking about burn, that set off a firestorm of commentary. I'm very anxious to know, what were your reaction when you heard that Netanyahu had said this?
Well, usually I'm quite soft-spoken, but in this particular case, I think it's total misrepresentation and falsehood, and therefore it doesn't even deserve to be discussed. Mm-hmm. It is so obviously a manipulative lie, which is typical of the Prime Minister of Israel. So, but this time, perhaps he went a bit too far.
Mm-hmm. Of course, your book concerns itself with the Zionist movement and how the creation of the State of Israel, where there was always a difference of opinion about what its mission was. And this matter of the how to characterize Palestinian leadership and their views, this has been similar kinds of ideas or words have been spoken by previous leaders, have they not?
I don't think I follow your question.
I guess I'm getting at this point that, of course, there was a resistance on the part of the Palestinian people, the Arab nation altogether, when under British mandate. And many Zionists took the view that those people speaking on behalf of Palestinians going way back were somehow anti-Semitic. And thought along the lines of this mufti. As a matter of fact, could you enlighten us at who the mufti is, in your opinion, and where historically to place him?
Well, mufti was one of the leaders of Palestinians. One should say that the Palestinian society was not politically organized at the time. It took them several decades to organize politically. They had different leaders speaking for them. Mm-hmm. This mufti in particular was a relatively minor figure. However, and this is important, in the Encyclopedia of the Holocaust published in Israel, the chapter on this mufti is longer than the chapter on Himmler and other Nazi leaders. Mm-hmm. Which means that there is a real consistent effort to show Palestinians as implacable foes of the Jews going back far. And this, of course, is a political agenda which is quite understandable in the conditions of the Zionist project, that they have to justify what they have done by the fact that we don't have an interlocutor, we have no one to talk with, and they hated us from time immemorial. Mm-hmm. This is precisely the ground on which this particular lie that you began your interview with grew. Mm-hmm. So it is indeed a standard procedure to present Palestinians as anti-Semitic, as enemies of the Jews, rather mm-hmm. than explain it in much more rational terms, that when your land and house is taken away, somehow you don't like the person who did it.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, you, of course, have lived in Israel. You are originally from Russia, so you have you've been able to sort of sample the views. What do you think of what sort of reaction within Israel and the Jewish community towards Netanyahu? Is this going to bring about a kind of a new discussion of how they ought to be approaching the issue of the Palestinians?
No, in my view, and I've spoken with a few people I know in Israel, no one takes it seriously because he really went way too far. No one's taking it seriously at this point. It may become serious later, but at this point, it's considered just a lie and total exaggeration.
Yeah, but
historically, it's just historically totally incorrect. Professor Zimmerman in Israel is professor of German history, and he said that what Netanyahu said is similar to Holocaust denial. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what qualifies for Holocaust denial, but I just thought that this idea should be conveyed to your listeners.
Yes, I, given what you just said, I mean, actually, maybe this would jeopardize the leadership of Netanyahu. It does seem kind of an aberration to change to move the responsibility for the initiative, the advocacy of the genocide of Jews onto a relatively lost figure in history with no influence, but to suggest that. Do you think that it's at all possible that Netanyahu has actually jeopardized his position as prime minister?
No, I don't think he. Actually, Netanyahu is one of the more moderate members of his government.
Oh, boy.
The current government is much way to the right of Netanyahu. They're much more nationalist and exclusive nationalist. Mm-hmm. So perhaps, you know, I don't want to guess, but certainly this kind of statement may actually improve his position within the government that he had. And one should realize that Israel is a democracy, and the government reflects the society that elects it. Mm-hmm. It's particularly because, unlike Canada, it's a proportionate system. So what you have is what the society is. Mm-hmm. And the society has moved a lot more to the right, to exclusive nationalism, to practically giving up on any compromise with the Palestinians. And so they're moving very fast towards a society in which, we already have people living in the same territory having different rights. That certainly applies to the entire West Bank. Mm-hmm. And I think that it has become the normal situation in Israel. Some people call it apartheid. Other people compare it with South Africa and say that it's not as bad in South Africa. Some South Africans say, in fact, it's worse than what was in South Africa. But what we do see is that there is less and less room for compromise because, as one Palestinian negotiator put it, and I think it's quite an apt comparison, since the Oslo Accord, we've been discussing how to divide a pizza, except one of us was eating it.
We have this backdrop of the past 2-3 weeks, maybe it's been it's longer, we've had a kind of state crisis where Palestinians and Israelis have lost their lives. I think upwards of 50 Palestinians have been killed, and it's... It turns somewhat on the issue of religion, which is, I know, at the core of your analysis as to who is speaking on behalf of Jews in this situation, because we have the disputed site of where you have the temple and then you have the mosque. Can you talk about how that's being approached and how it might, in your view, be handled?
Well, my book deals with intra-Jewish issues of religion and politics. It doesn't really address the issue of Muslims and Jews. But I did write another article on Jewish attitude towards Muslims and Islam. And in fact, I would like to preface my explanation by saying that the relations between Jews and Muslims traditionally were a lot more harmonious than they were between Jews and Christians in the countries where Jews live. And the issue of holy sites becomes important, becomes inflammatory, because there is a political problem, and it's a lot easier to mobilize the masses under the banner of religion than under political banner. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, we have a political, rather simple problem. It's not a complicated problem, that there were Palestinians living all over their country. Many of them were displaced. They constitute today several million of refugees. And those who are not refugees live in much worse conditions than the Zionist settlers who have come for the last 100 years. That breeds frustration. That breeds frustration, particularly because negotiations between Israel and Palestinians really have never produced anything tangible, for the simple reason, I would say, that there's a very sharp imbalance of power, economic power, political power, certainly military power, between Israel and the Palestinians. There's no incentive for Israel to compromise because they're much, much stronger. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a religious conflict what we have now. What we have now is simply a manifestation of a deep frustration on the part of Palestinians and a growing growing extreme margin within Israeli society, people who take the laws into their own hands and commit acts of violence against Palestinians. So you have frustrated Palestinians and somewhat extreme Israelis who take the law into their own hands. For example, many settlers burn olive trees belonging to Palestinians. They make their life very difficult. Mm-hmm. So we have to see this deep, deep frustration on the part of the Palestinians as the real cause. And it's not a religious conflict at all between Israel and the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem the way this began to unfold with the British had a mandate, I think it was called that.
Yes.
And during that time, I don't know what the terms of a mandate are, but they began to make decisions about how they would, I guess the word would be, decolonize. They don't seem to be neither the British nor the Americans, who are both say they have a special relationship to Israel. Neither of them seem to be very concerned, or not sufficiently to get the attention of Israeli leaders.
Well, again, what we see, if I understand you correctly, you're saying why Israel doesn't experience any serious pressure from
That's
Western
right.
powers
yes.
Today. Well, it doesn't experience any pressure because essentially its policies are approved both by the United States and by most Western countries. So whenever Israel goes slightly beyond the usual practice of dispossession of Palestinians, it does something more violent. Mm-hmm. There would be occasional cries of regret and calls to stem the violence. But essentially, Western powers have never imposed any sanctions on Israel. Unlike it, we recently saw, sanctions were imposed on Iran, on North Korea, mm-hmm. on Russia. Mm-hmm. And they were imposed very fast, and they've been renewed every 6 months or so. So when Western powers want really to achieve results, they know how to do it. But Israel is dealt with kid gloves. Mm-hmm. And because what Israel does essentially is for the benefit of the Western powers.
Mm-hmm. It probably not a happy. It doesn't suggest any short-term solution, doesn't There is a new further crisis in the region, and I want to get your opinion about, which might impinge on this whole matter, and that is the fighting in Syria, which involves, everyone agrees, people called terrorists, and they, the U.S. has been conducting a kind of a strategy there. For about 2 years, I think, they've been flying over Syrian airspace. But now a second party has begun to fly there, and you are from Russia, so you know some, quite a bit about all these things. I'll bring it down to this. Jean Chrétien was asked what he thought, just prior to our election, as a matter of fact, of the presence of the Russians' planes. And he said, if Putin wants to fight the terrorists, what's wrong with that? I didn't notice media here taking it up, but I want to know what you think. What is this new phenomenon of the Russians making their presence felt? Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, the Russian Air Force is the only one that whose presence in Syria is legitimate. It had been asked by the Syrian government. None of the Western powers have ever been asked to violate Syrian airspace and to fight anyone there. That's number one. Number two, the terrorists that are being targeted had been financed and organized and armed by Western powers who wanted to dethrone President Assad. Mm-hmm. It was a violent version of regime change that the United States pursued in Syria. And this is part of a larger plan, which, again, it's not a conspiracy theory because there are published papers in late 90s about this, that the whole area around Israel should be weakened so that there should be no strong state able to confront Israel. And if you see today in 2015, and indeed there is no strong state around Israel that is capable of confronting Israel. So Iraq is in shambles, Syria is mm-hmm. certainly badly weakened. And what we see is a chaos that Western intervention often produces. It produced that in Afghanistan. It produced that in Iraq. Now it's producing it in Syria. So we should really ask ourselves if it's not part of a consistent strategy to create chaos in those areas. And the intervention of Russia, again, no one even mentioned international law in the Western media. You practically don't find it. Even Jean Chrétien didn't mention it. Mm-hmm. But the Russian Air Force is the only air force there that is there on legitimate grounds. Mm-hmm. Today, we live in a world of that might makes right. Mm-hmm. That the United States can intervene, and they intervene. Who asked them to intervene in Syria? They don't have United Nations mandate. They don't have permission of the Syrian government, but we've become very accustomed to this kind of operations, unilateral, because the United States spends on defense a lot more, I think, more than the rest of the world. So what we see is a direct consequence of Western intervention in the Middle East, and of course I didn't mention Libya, which was another successful case where actually the intervention in Libya was commanded by a Canadian admiral, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. So we have nothing to be proud of. Libya, again, is in shambles. Mm-hmm. So what we see, wherever they go, they leave total disorder, a lot of violence, and particularly suffering for millions of innocent people. Mm-hmm. And that's what we forget, that whoever wins, the people who will lose are the civilian population that has been misplaced, has been displaced from their homes, that have been living in refugee camps, be they in Turkey, Jordan, or in Europe. But it's not a happy situation. And I hope, well, I'm not sure, I'm not a militarist expert, I hope that the Russian intervention at least will bring an end to the civil war in Syria, mm-hmm. and particularly to the Western intervention in Syria.
Mm-hmm. This is Professor Yakov Rapkin, and there's an additional point there that you raised. That use that word. We used to hear it many years ago. Unilateralism. The U.S. Says it's fighting terrorism, and you must take heart from the fact that the others are beginning to raise the issue, certainly Mr. Putin did, of saying, well, let us then do this collaboratively. If we agree that terrorism is bad, then why can't we have one resolution of it? Why does it have to be NATO? Why does it have to be one side with the other excluded? And could you talk about why that policy exists?
Well, because the United States and its allies have become accustomed over the last 20 years to be the only military power capable of intervening in other countries. And they started doing it without United Nations mandate, without any basis in international law. It has happened on many occasions. So what we see is the sense of exceptionalism, which is typical of United States ruling circles, and that sense of exceptionalism makes it possible to intervene in other countries when it is directly against international law. Mm-hmm. Now, again, Israel has played a very important role in all that because it showed the example. Israel bombed Syria many times without any slap on its hand from the international community. Israel always feels very free to bomb surrounding countries. The United States didn't do it for a while, but now, in a way, they follow in the footsteps of the Israelis and they do pretty much the same thing. They're sitting on a much larger scale. If you look at who was violating international law regularly, it was Israel that pursued bombing operations all around. Now you have Western powers doing pretty much the same thing. So we're really seeing a very profound Israeli influence on security issues in the West, be it security in its international dimension, or be it simple security, security of corporations, security of airports, and so on, where Israeli companies have played a very important role. For example, South African soccer championship was entirely equipped with security equipment from Israel. Israelis are very successful because they face a permanent challenge of controlling a very unwilling population of Palestinians. Therefore, Israeli have acquired tremendous expertise that is now eagerly sought in many Western countries, including Canada. I must mention the previous government, Mr. Harper's government, signed several security cooperation agreements with Israel. And I don't know if the Trudeau government is going to revise those. I doubt it will. So Canada is deeply involved in Israeli security industry.
Well, probably I should then make the last question. I suppose you took some heart from the fact that the new prime minister says that he is going to withdraw planes from flying over Syria. That is somewhat encouraging, I suppose.
Yes, it is encouraging, and it's also encouraging that it did not provoke any adverse reaction from President Obama, who was the first to find out about it in the conversation with Mr. Trudeau. I don't know exactly the wording, but if Mr. Trudeau is going to say we are withdrawing them for the simple reason that they don't have any basis in international law to be there, mm-hmm. that would be very nice and refreshing.
It would indeed. Professor Yakov Rebkin, we're very grateful. It's most enlightening. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Good talking to you. Bye-bye. That's Professor Yakov Rebkin. His book, a very highly regarded book, I urge people to get it, A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. You can find it, of course, we have the internet, and he writes frequently on many topics. And what great qualifications that he is from Russia. He has lived in Israel. He lives in Canada. He travels the world. And he has language can give you so much breadth. He doesn't have to go to the New York Times to have somebody tell him, or the Globe and Mail, et cetera. And so you're listening to The Taylor Report. It's CIT 89.5. FM. You can write to us, Taylor at UT.fm. By the way, I first saw Professor Rapkin at the Science for Peace gathering here. It must have been 2 years ago. We had him on the program previous. And I would tell you there were several speakers, but I only remember him. Oh, wait a minute. To be fair, Eve Engler also spoke. So I remember too. But his books are profound, and I think they should be on everybody's table.